ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes with us each and every week. Without any further ado, let's introduce him right now, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm great, my man. Doing just fabulous, Brian. Glad to be here. Got old Lightning saddled up, and we're ready to ride whenever you get ready, man.
Before we get going with anything, we just want to say briefly here at the top, we usually talk about the Super Studcast here. We're going to do that later in the show because I want to get to where we're going this week, Ron, because I know we just did the Harley Race tribute, but this is somewhat of a similar vein that we're starting this week's episode, correct?
Yeah. First thing today, I'd like to pay tribute to two more fallen stars of Southern Rings. They both died on August the 15th, 2019, just days basically after Harley's passing. And, we're going to discuss not only those two guys, but we're going to discuss major Southeastern talent changes in late June and early July 1975. And due to the tremendous response of fans about the first three-day Southeastern events episode last week, we're going to break down this week, June 27th, 1975, that three-day weekend in the same fashion, including the payoffs. And we'll finish with the trip, my first trip back to Florida to wrestle since I arrived in Knoxville 8 months earlier. So we're all over the road and flying again, and it should be really an interesting episode, I think.
So you mentioned two great stars that have just passed away in the last week, just after Harley Race passed away. Like you said, they weren't just wrestling stars, but they were Southern wrestling stars. Why don't we start there, Ron? Why don't we talk a little bit about what's happened the last week?
Okay, these two great stars were loved and admired by fans, obviously, in the South. I think they did most of their work in the South, except for one of them who actually spent a lot of time out West. And like I said a second ago, they both died on the same day, August 15th, 1975. And a couple weeks ago, we did that tribute to Harley Race in Studcast number 107. And fans, if you didn't get to hear that one, you can find it, obviously, at tnstud.com, iTunes, Spotify, all those podcast outlets out there. And you can hear what I had to say about Harley Race. But right now, let's focus on Leon Baxter, the wrestling pro, and Eddie Marlin, who was the mummy for a while. So let's begin today with Leon Baxter. He was born in Malone, Florida, June 4th, 1938. And Leon was 5 foot 10 inches, 230 pounds. He was a fireplug of a man that had strength way beyond his own comprehension. My father trained him in 1958 in Dothan, Alabama, in that area. Now, Malone is right there in basically 20, 30 miles outside of Dothan, Alabama. My dad always said that Leon was the toughest wrestler that he ever trained. And Dad's training back in those days was all shooting and nothing more. And if you weren't tough enough to handle being stretched for an hour or more each workout, Dad hurt you bad enough that you just never came back. Leon was a rare breed that never failed to show up for the next workout. In fact, I think Dad said he's the only guy he ever trained that never failed to come to every workout. And when my dad decided Leon was ready to go and finished with him, teaching him how to shoot, he didn't really know a hell of a lot about working because Dad never taught people to work. He only taught them to shoot. He sent Leon Baxter to Oklahoma, where there's some great talent and some great shooters. Danny Hodges is out there. Ken Mantell is out there. A guy named Joe McCarthy, who was trained by my grandfather Roy and Herb Welch way back when my dad was training out of Dyersburg, Tennessee, the town I was born in, and went to Oklahoma and never left that territory. They fell in love with Joe McCarthy. In fact, Danny Hodge said he liked wrestling Joe McCarthy better than any wrestler he ever wrestled in his life. And I asked him one time when he said that, why is that, Danny? And he said, because every night he tried me. He said, you know, it's supposed to be a work, but he said in the middle of a match, he would just bam. He'd all of a sudden he'd just stiffen up and here he would try to beat me. And he said, I loved that guy. He just really loved him. So, you know, this guy, Leon, is just really a totally different individual. And so when he sends Leon to Oklahoma to work for Leroy, Dad suggests to Leroy that he just book Leon against the fans from the audience each night just to prove that wrestlers were tough and then nobody's going to be able to beat him. Dad told Leroy that Leon had been wrestling the Marks for months in the Gulf Coast Territory, which was his territory that he owned, and that he had never been beaten in the challenge that he was doing. And the challenge was with the Marks, and the challenge was different than the Dale Lewis challenge that I was, in which Dale Lewis, if you could beat Dale, you got $1,000. Well, if you hit this guy, Leon, in less than 10 minutes, you got $1,000. Dale had no time limit on his, and he really didn't have to beat Marks, but he beat them all, and so did Leon, I'm sure. Brian, how much is $1,000 back in 1958 compared to what the value is of that in today's money?
Ron, $1,000 in 1958 is, in 2019 dollars, $8,877.89.
So I can understand why Leroy was skeptical about the possibility of losing that kind of money, because that's what he told Dad. He goes, wait a minute, you know, that's a lot of money, man. And he told Dad that, you know, and Dad said, Dad told him, he said, I'll tell you what, Leroy, he goes, the guy is good enough that if anybody ever beats him, I'll pay the $1,000. And that was all. That's all Leroy needed to hear. So Leroy says, heck yeah, send him here, man. So needless to say, Dad never lost a penny. And Leroy never used Leon in a normal wrestler position. Instead, he booked him for the entire time in his huge Oklahoma territory, all around that territory, taking on fans night after night. And when Leroy got ready for Leon to leave, Leroy sent him to Oregon to shoot with Marks for promoter Don Owens. And, you know, I know that Leon left a lot of guys laying, no doubt, in Oklahoma before he went on to Oregon to do the same thing for Don Owens. So Leon Baxter spends his first 2 years on the road, mostly in the Western United States, leaving marks laying everywhere. And when he returned to Alabama in the early 1960s, the Fields brothers at that point owned Gulf Coast Wrestling because Dad and the family had moved on to Memphis. And they finally put Leon in the ring for the first time with other wrestlers. He became an instant star for the next 18 years until 1978 when he retired. At one point, Leon became a sheriff's deputy for the Houston County Sheriff's Department in the 1960s, and they made him wear a mask if he was going to continue as a wrestler because they didn't want one of their sheriff deputies being recognized as a wrestler. And when he put the mask on, he named himself the wrestling pro. He was in a white hood and a white tights. and he became an even bigger star as the wrestling pro than he had been as Leon Baxter. Fabulously strong guy, Leon Baxter, the wrestling pro, became a legend everywhere along the Gulf Coast and wherever he had been. Wrestlers and fans who knew him will always respect and admire his fantastic talent long after his death on August the 15th. And on the same day, August the 15th, 2019, another great talent, Eddie Marlin, died in Nashville, Tennessee, the same city he was born in, on August 13th, 1930. I remember Eddie Marlin very well. He was a star in our time frame here, the 1975 that we're talking about today. And he was a star in Memphis, Louisville, all of the area in which he was born and raised. Jerry Jarrett is actually the son-in-law of Eddie Marlin. And Jerry had been on many of those 1975 Knoxville cards in the past Studcast. I'm sure fans will remember it, Studcast fans. And Eddie was also a famous mask wrestler, except he wore not just a mask, but a complete outfit. And it was a mummy outfit, and they called him the mummy. He worked at least one Knoxville card in the winter of 1975 for me as the mummy and several for me as Eddie Marlin. The most memorable thoughts I have of Eddie Marlin was what a tremendous Southern gentleman he was and the way he conducted himself both inside and outside the ring. He was a class act, and may God bless these two wrestlers along with the legendary Harley Race who also recently passed. Brian, it seems like we're losing more great ones every day and some that'll never be replaced. That's for sure.
That's for sure, but at least we get an opportunity to talk about them a little bit here and share their memories, share their legacies with the listeners. One question for you, Ron, before we move on to Southeastern in 1975. The wrestling pro retired in 78. Did he retire when the Fields brothers sold to you? Did he ever actually work for you? Or, you know, what's the story there with his retirement?
Worked many times for me in 78. I used him a lot. He was older at that point. I couldn't really push him, and the problem for Leon was the fact that the Fields boys had kind of gotten away. Lee Fields had gotten in the car racing business and owned a track in Mobile, Alabama, and they had kind of drifted away from wrestling. They didn't have a great crew when I bought in there, and I brought in some really good wrestlers in the early 1978. And just maintained that level and actually got much better talent as time went on. Leon couldn't really compete with a lot of the guys that I had, but he still worked for me quite a bit. He still had a great fan following, and he helped me to get Southeastern off the ground, because when you're trying to get new guys over, you need those guys that have been in the territory for a while that have the respect of the fans. And when a guy beats one of those guys, it's a meaningful win. And that's the way you get guys over. And Leon did a great job for me by getting several different guys over that came through in 1978 and 79 in Southeastern once we moved to Pensacola.
Well, Ron, let's now get back to the sequential story of the Studcast. I think we're in the end of June 1975. We're talking Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville.
That's it. Then talent's about to change dramatically over the next few weeks in this time frame. Let's start with the very popular Ricky Gibson, who had been in Southeastern for only about a month, and most of that time as the Tennessee Tag Champion along with partner Jimmy Golden. Ricky surprises me on Friday, June the 20th, 1975, with a one-week notice that he needed to leave because of a sickness in his family. Now, Ricky Gibson is the brother of Robert Gibson, obviously of rock and roll fame, and was a very big family man. His mother was very sick, legitimately, and I hated to lose him. But something about a sick mother carried a lot of weight with me, I guess because of my situation nowadays. And I had a lot of respect for Ricky, for his family, because he, and it made a big impact on me that he wanted and just felt like, I got to go home. I got to go home and help my mom. And I really kind of appreciated that attitude that he had. This notice had an impact also on Jimmy Golden, who was one half of the Tennessee Tag Champions. Within a month, Jimmy, too, is going to be gone from the territory because Jimmy grew so very close to Ricky during their title run that Jimmy just, he was decimated that Ricky left. And it made it difficult for all of us because Ricky was a great little young star and he was really getting over. So Ricky's gone. In comes Rock Hunter, a heel and close friend of Jody Hamilton, the Assassin. He joins the crew on this episode, as a matter of fact. And there's a new tag team coming named the Outlaws, Ken Dillinger and Cowboy Ron Parker. And they're going to arrive the following week, next week. And I'd never seen them work, but they were recommended to me by my good friend and the NWA world champion, Jack Briscoe. One other thing is new. I've had time to get Southeastern tag belts made, and we'll be changing from the Tennessee Tag Championship to the Southeastern Tag Championship. That transition is going to be very quick and seamless. The Tennessee Tag Champions, Golden and Gibson, are going to be beaten on Friday night, June 27th in Knoxville, and the new champions will be declared the Southeastern Tag Champions and the Tennessee Tag Champions. And I will basically kind of put the Tennessee Tag Championship belts on the shelf for a while. I won't use them for a while. And we get our first Southeastern Championships belts made, and now we are legitimately looking like Southeastern Wrestling.
Where did you get the belts made, and how far in advance did you have to order them?
Well, I don't, be honest with you, Brian, I don't really remember who made these for me. I know that later on I got belts made by, he was the best. His name doesn't come to me right off, but he made the best belts in the country.
Reg Parks?
That's it, Reggie. Reggie, what a fantastic belts he made. But I don't think he made these first belts for me, my first Southeastern belts in Knoxville. When I come back there in 1988 and I start USA Wrestling, he makes both the tag team belts and the USA Heavyweight Championship belt that I still have in my home. So Reggie, to me, is one of the best belt makers of all time. Let's break down... But the Southeastern three-day weekend of June 27, 1975. Again, we're going to be in the same three cities as we were on the last episode. Middlesbrough, Kentucky on a Thursday night, June 26th. On Friday the 27th, we're in Knoxville. On Saturday the 28th, we're back in Morristown again. Middlesbrough, Kentucky card on Thursday, June 26th, was the exact same card that's going to be in Morristown two nights later. The first match was Les Thatcher versus Tony Peters. Thatcher was well received by the crowd in the National Guard Army in Middlesbrough and defeated a much larger opponent in Tony Peters. The crowd is significantly larger than the week before, which I was very happy to see, by 40%. And that is exactly what I needed to happen to make these three-day weekends profitable for me as well as the wrestlers. The second match was the club-footed Inferno Rocky Smith without his mask versus Devoy Brunson. This one went about a 30-minute time limit draw. Was a good match that really had the fans going in the last 10 minutes. Third match was a great one, Spudnik Monroe against Tommy Siegler. Spudnik got the crowd going and got a big pop when Siegler used his sleeper at the end to put the old pro out. And he put him out, and, you know, the fans loved it. Anytime Monroe got beat, most of the crowd loved it. Main event was the crowd favorites, Ron and Don Wright against the Assassin and myself. And we would not be returning for 3 weeks to Middlesbrough again after this match, so I decided to give them a hot finish in which the Assassin and I screwed the baby faces. As was typical with Eastern Kentucky towns, we had a hard time leaving the ring, and we had to have a short discussion with the police. I had to look the police up afterward and say, guys, you know, you need to come to the ring and escort us, not wait until we fight our way through the crowd to escort us to the door. You know, it seemed pretty basic to me, but to those guys, they're like, oh, you mean we need to come up there and take you back? I said, oh, well, yes. Could you see that tonight? So, you know, what happens there is in the future, there are going to be countless sellouts in that part of the state of Kentucky and in that part of the country. And there's also going to be just about countless riots, too, from that same part of the country. Those fans were rabid down there. They loved their wrestling. And you really had to stay on top of the police to keep somebody from getting hurt there.
What did you say, Ron? Was the attendance up 40% or was the gate up 40%?
They both were up 40%. The gate was up 40% and the house was up 40%. Last week, the first show was 600 and this time was 1,000 fans. We just about packed out the little old National Guard Army there in Middlesboro. We grossed $3,000. The total payoff was $900, and that was split among the 10 guys on the card, including the referee. But again, I didn't take a payoff. So the bottom four on that card, Tony Peters, Devoy Brunson, Rocky Smith, and the referee made $75. The top guys, Les Thatcher, Sputnik Monroe, Tommy Sigler, Ron and Don Wright, and the assassin got $100 each. So then let's take a look at the Saturday night town, and we'll come back and pick the Friday up. The card there was exactly the same as it was in Middlesboro two nights earlier, and the finishes were all the same as well because the two cities are more than 100 miles apart, and we're in our infancy there at Southeastern, and fans aren't following us every night, night after night. So I didn't have to worry about finishes being seen, and at that point, that's what we were doing. That's the way we're handling business. Crowd in Marstown was also up about 200 people from the week before to 1,200 people, and it had been 1,000 the week before. Gross house was up to 3,600. The total payoff was almost 1,100. Bottom guys got 90 each. The top guys got 120 each. And I did not take a payoff, and I spread my 120 among all the other 10 guys on the card. And I'm going to continue to do that until Southeastern takes off. And once it does, then I won't need to do that in order for my talent to be able to make enough money to stay with me. Now we come to Knoxville in Chilhowee Park on June 27th, 1975. I'll give everyone the card and the results of the matches that first night. And at the end of the studcast today, I'll give the fans, like I did last week, the payoffs for not only Knoxville, but the payoffs for the total 3 days that those wrestlers were there for me in 1975. First match on that June 27th, 1975 card in Knoxville was Tony Peters versus Rocky Smith, the former Inferno, the club-footed Inferno. Rocky got as much as possible out of a much larger Tony Peters and got a good pop at the finish. Second match, George McCrary versus Steve Kovacs. This one had a lot of wrestling because of McCrary's background, and Kovacs was a pretty decent wrestler, and he was the winner in this match. Third match, Tommy Sigler with a very overmatched Steve Kyle. We recorded this one for TV the following day. Tommy got another great win with a sleeper hold and really was starting to get over at this point. Fourth match was Ron Wright versus Sputnik Monroe. That's a great one right there. Sputnik went to the ring first and got his heat as only Sputnik could do. He had a way of just aggravating people, just walking to the ring more than any guy I ever saw. The fans were booing Monroe like crazy by the time Ron Wright even arrived at ringside. And these two great veterans had a barn burner, man, that set up perfectly for the main event that night. And the main event that night, the Assassin and I, we're facing the Tennessee Tag Champions, Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson, in a lumberjack match. And lumberjack matches just mean that all the other wrestlers on the car come out to the mat, to the ring, and they surround the ring. And any time a contestant is thrown out of the ring, jumps out of the ring, or however he escapes from the ring, they throw him back into the ring. Tennessee tag belts are on the line in this match, but so are the brand new, beautiful Southeastern tag belts that were introduced at the beginning of the match. So this match ultimately became a very rare double championship match with both belts and titles on the line in the same match. And remember at the beginning of the show, Ricky Gibson giving me the 1 week notice. Well, tonight, the Assassin and I, we had to take those titles because Gibson was leaving. And that fact really made it difficult for me as the booker because I didn't want to lose a talented guy like Gibson, much less a team like Gibson and Golden. Young studs, man, they were getting it done. Nevertheless, we did what had to be done. We had a terrific match when me and the Assassin took most of the matches from the babyfaces because Ricky was leaving. And we had to get ourselves over fast. We hadn't had many matches together as a team, and I didn't expect this to happen. The finish involved it involved Ricky injuring his leg on a leapfrog, and the assassin and I worked that leg that he had hurt for 20 minutes. And I made a point in the dressing room when we talked about this finish. I said, 20 minutes, we're going to keep you under control. We're going to work your leg until the fans are going crazy to you make that tag to Jimmy. When that tag did come, the hot tag, the crowd exploded, and Jimmy made a great comeback. And Ricky just laid in the corner on the apron selling his leg because we had been on it for so long. And Jimmy and the assassin fought out to the floor on the outside of the ring close to the corner, close to my corner. And here come all the eight lumberjacks that are surrounding the ring, came to get them back into the ring. And I just dropped off the apron and crawled underneath the ring, got over to where Gibson was on his side. There was nobody there to stop me from doing what I wanted. I grabbed him by his hurt leg and dragged him over to the post. And I wrapped his leg around that post, steel ring post, a couple of times. And then when they saw me doing that over there, here came a couple of them to get me back. I crawled back under the ring and came back to the same place that I started at. Ricky Gibson was a great seller all of his career. He slowly crawled back up on the apron and he hung over the top rope once Jimmy got back in there with his injured leg just dangling down. I mean, he wouldn't put any weight on it. Jimmy's in trouble. And by this point, you know, we got Jimmy going and there's poor old Ricky standing over there. He can't even put any weight on his bad leg. And we're beating the hell out of Jimmy, me and the assassin. So Jimmy finally has to make a tag to him. He can't. He's trying not to because he realizes that Ricky's hurt. But he finally makes a hot tag, and Gibson comes in, and he makes a comeback, and a damn good comeback considering that he never failed to act like his leg was just torn off. Crowd was really into it and cool. Jimmy got to jumping in the ring. He was going to join into the action, and the referee goes to stop him. When that happened, Ricky picked up the assassin, going to try to slam him, which that was an odd move. And I just sneaked in and I dived and hit him just below the knee in that bad right leg that we'd been working on. And down he went. The assassin's a big boy on top of him, and the referee made the three count and he raised our hands. The assassin and I were handed both sets of belts. We had a great celebration in the ring and then a difficult time getting back to the dressing room. I mean, the fans were just really pissed with this one. And Jimmy could not get Ricky back up on his feet. And the babyface lumberjacks had to actually carry Ricky back to the dressing room. So the finish was hot, and we had recorded the match to show it the next day on TV. That wasn't all that was going on TV the next day, though. We're going to spice it up, and that's what I call it. We're going to spice things up by taking it to another level on the television the next day.
We will return to hear how Ron spiced things up in just a moment. But first, a word about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 20, with the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Ike.
Fans and patrons worldwide eagerly await the arrival of every new Super Studcast, number 20, with the Universal Heartthrob Austin Idol, has caught fire with the fans at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Part 1, now available, has captured the emotions of listeners with tremendous humor and friendship between two legends and real-life horror with the discussion of a horrible plane crash that took the life of one of the best to ever put on wrestling tights, Bobby Shane. It is what Super Studcasts have become, a roller coaster ride of wrestling history that never ends. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for 3 unforgettable hours. Part 2 will be released on Tuesday, August 27th. If you're not riding with these Super Studcasts, you certainly should be.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 20, out now. Patrons of the Studcast at patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. Hear the Tennessee Stud reunite with the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. Check it out today only $2.99 gets you in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. We'll have more information later in the show. But once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, before we went to the break, you mentioned you were going to spice things up. How do you spice things up? I mean, this seems like you're in a pretty bad position. Ricky Gibson, who you get and instantly turn into a young babyface who people love there, he's gone pretty quickly after he arrives. What do you do? How do you spice up your show?
Well, we've began to cook the meal, basically. You know, I guess the spicing up is a word that it's in relation to cooking usually. And the meal starts to get cooked on the Friday night when we hurt Ricky's leg. And we're going to carry that hot pan on into television on the Saturday afternoon. It's the 7th Southeastern Wrestling Program on WBIR. It's about this point that I can feel a change in the number of people that recognize me as a wrestler after 7 weeks on this new big station. In the almost 30 total TV shows we did at the old Big Jim Hess station, I hardly ever got recognized on the street. And in one quarter of that number of programs on the new station, they're now starting to recognize me and stop me and say something to me. Or I just see them. You can tell. They don't really have to say anything. They look at you and you recognize that, oh, they recognize who I am. That's going to be the case. It's going to grow to a point that we barely could go out in 77 and 78, early 79. We couldn't go out anywhere, wrestlers, without being just inundated with people in restaurants and movie theaters. Wherever you went, everybody knew what you were and who you were. So this is starting to happen for me now. Crowds are not huge after only these 7 shows, but I never expected they were going to be huge after 7 shows. I was really hoping that it was going to make a difference in attendance by the 12th show, but I was feeling pretty good about what was happening after 7 shows. As I said earlier, and you asked about it, Brian, we're going to spice this angle up and even more so spice up my tag combination with the Assassin. And I use that term spice up from a cooking reference, as I just said, because we're going to make things a lot hotter on this show than they were before. 2 weeks prior, we did our first live angle on TV. And this week, we're going there again, but in a totally different way. Normally, I would not have done another angle on TV this soon, but this out of the blue, 1 week notice by Gibson has kind of forced my hand. Instead of being able to slowly work through a program with 2 great young baby faces that ideally the Assassin and I would have gotten at least 6 weeks out of this, the loss of Gibson has cut that down to 2 weeks. So in a relatively new territory, that's what I'm dealing with here. Southeastern has only been there for 7 months at this point. It's got a brand new TV on a new television station that's not been associated with wrestling before. A quick notice like the one Ricky gave me would involving a babyface tag team, your only babyface tag team, basically, except for Ron and Don Wright. It could have been disastrous for my business for Southeastern. So I'm sitting here in a real bad position. We're going into TV that morning, and it's time for me to figure out how to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. That's kind of the position I'm in at this point.
So how do you do that? What do you do to spice things up? Like you said, you have Ricky Gibson, you have Jimmy Golden, you and the Assassin. Perfect combination of 2 heels and 2 young baby faces the fans like. That's out the window now. What do you do?
Well, first of all, we had to really push. The Assassin and I both had to really push ourselves now to get ourselves over as quickly as possible. If you don't have the good baby faces, you got to have great heat as heels. And so I didn't even have another baby face combination, like I said, except for the 2 rights. And this situation with Ricky, it was going to test my ability as a young booker. And I have another top team that's arriving the following Friday, but that happens to also be a heel team. If it had been a babyface team, that would have been a spot they could have moved into right away. So it's going to be interesting for Studcast fans, I think, and to see in the next month how I work myself out of this hole. because I'm really in a hold here with Ricky's real quick notice and being gone right away. I'm in a hold here. So let's dig into this, how I'm going to spice it up and how I'm going to turn this. This is a critical show here because I got to come out of there, me and the assassin, with a ton of heat in order to be able to move forward with the promotion and not let us lapse back into smaller crowds because fans are so lost with Ricky Gibson being gone and not having something to cheer for. So let's talk about the Knoxville match on Friday, July 4th, that's going to be upcoming. First of all, it had to be at this point, we had to really focus on me and the assassin, and that's what this show is going to be. It's going to be the Ron Fuller and Assassin show. And you do that by having us out there at least 3, 4, maybe even 5 times in one show. But this time we're going to be there on 5 different occasions during this 1-hour program. When Les opens the show and starts to run down the card, the assassin and I come right out immediately, interrupt him to brag about our new belts. And Les, in his normal fashion, is a little bit upset, doesn't really expect we're going to do it. And he's trying to get control of his show. And well, we're talking over him and we're standing behind him. And while he's trying to talk about what they're going to see today, we're showing the belts to the fans and patting each other on the back. He gets frustrated with us because he didn't get a decent and controlled opening for his show like he always wanted. And when that becomes obvious to the fans watching, it just puts more heat on us and it makes Les a bigger baby face. It worked out great. I mean, if I had told him we're going to do it, it probably wouldn't have been as good. I just laid it on him. As soon as he started to open up, I said, come on, let's go. Let's go, Jody. And we went right out there and put Les in that position. And it just really turned out good to get us heat, and it also make him a better baby face.
What was the first segment on the show, Ron?
First segment on the show is a match, very good new heel from Atlanta called Rock Hunter. He's a longtime friend of Jody Hamilton, the assassin, and they're going to both live in Atlanta. They're going to be able to drive back and forth from Atlanta together. It leaves Jody with someone to give him a little help with the driving and to ride with him back and forth every weekend. It's a good deal for both of those guys. He was not scheduled to wrestle until the next Friday, but I wanted to get him some exposure before his first ever live match in Knoxville, kind of like I had done with Tommy Sigler. He works with a very good baby face named Steve Kovacs in this first segment of the show, and that had gotten a win the night before at Chihuahua Park. So it was my first time to see Rock Hunter work. I was very impressed. I could tell he was going to be able to help me, just as the assassin had been telling me. In fact, it worked out great that he was there because I was now able to use him again later in the show to get even more heat on him in his first day there. So after that Rock Hunter match, Golden and Gibson, they come out to a huge ovation from the studio crowd. Gibson's limping really badly. He has a huge wrap around his right knee. They watched the video from the night before where Ricky got his knee injured. Studio audience was mesmerized watching the monitors around the studio as our win the night before unfolds for the home audience. They get their first chance to see it. Some of these people in that studio audience have seen this, but not anybody at home had ever seen this. So I'm sure they were mesmerized at home by watching this. At the end of that video, Les is very concerned for Ricky as a babyface team, as he reminds them, both Jimmy and Ricky, who were there for the interview, that they are scheduled to wrestle live in the next segment. And you know, Les is great at and his sympathy toward baby faces was exactly what people expected. And he was very concerned here. You could tell he was extremely concerned about Ricky. And he asked Ricky, are you okay? And Ricky says, yes, my leg is okay. But Jimmy says, no, it isn't, Les. And if there's any way you could talk to the promoters and put someone in and get them to put someone in our place for this match on TV today, that would be wonderful because I'm concerned, too, about Ricky's leg. Les promises to do his best, and they close out the interview and ends the first segment of the show.
So far on this show, you and the assassin have already been out there. Now you have Golden and Gibson out there. What's on the next segment of the show?
Okay, so, you know, after that two-minute commercial from the station, you know, all this goes on. They're watching the match, and they're actually talking to him about the match and how Ricky got his leg hurt and all that. And Les hasn't thrown it to commercial at this point. He throws it to the commercial. They leave the set. We're going to give Les time to try to talk to somebody about replacing them. Then we come on for the first interview. So we've been there for the opening of the show to make asses of ourselves, get a little bit of heat. And we come back after the two-minute commercial for the station, and we joined Les at the desk for that very first interview. And we start right off making our case that the young babyfaces should have to wrestle on the show. We point out that injuries are part of the sport. And if those young punks have any guts, they will wrestle on TV next. We just harp on the fact that it doesn't make any difference that the kid's got a hurt leg. What's he made out of? We won't find out. Let's see how he does today on a television match when he's got a little bit of a leg problem. So Les continues with his opinion that Ricky shouldn't be working on a knee as swollen as Ricky's. And then he brings up the fact that he'd spoken to Ricky, and Ricky has not even seen a doctor with his knee. We don't even know how bad he's hurt. And we laugh it all off like heels would, you know, and we demand that they wrestle on TV next segment, or we're going to refuse to give them the return title match for next week's card on Friday night, July 4th in Knoxville. The fans go crazy mad about that, you know, about now having the young guns here to having to wrestle on TV when one of them's hurt. And boy, we leave the end of that interview. I mean, the studio crowd is booing us like crazy. We are already creating some heat and creating some impact for this television program. Next segment, we open with Golden and Gibson in the ring. Gibson's knee is huge. He's got a bigger wrapping on it now, trying to protect it. And they're working with Rocky Smith and Steve Kyle. Jimmy started the match with Ricky, obviously selling his knees, just standing in the corner. You could tell he's hurt just standing there, that he shouldn't be out there. Jimmy does a great job of carrying all of the match for at least 15 minutes. He stays in the ring by himself against the two guys. And finally, they get him going, and he's done everything he can not to have to tag Ricky. So finally, once they got him stopped, Kyle and Smith, they're working Jimmy over pretty darn good. And Jimmy's blown up at this point. And he makes it obvious that he doesn't want to tag Ricky. He starts to go to Ricky's corner, and then he hesitates and turns around and goes right back into it again to sell the fact that I'm not going to tag him. I'm not going to put him in the ring. And finally, in order to keep from losing the match right in the middle of the ring, Jimmy's forced to tag Ricky. The studio crowd goes crazy as Ricky does his best one-leg comeback. That's what I'll call it. He made a pretty darn amazing comeback with just one leg. And when Ricky scoops up style Steve Kyle to slam him and probably get the guys a victory at that point, me and the assassin hit the ring from out of nowhere. The assassin does the same thing to Ricky that I had done to him the night before. He's got that guy up in the air above him. He's trying to hold him up on one leg, and assassin hits him below the knee, just torpedoes him right below the knee, and down he goes again. The guy goes down on top of him. The referee obviously starts ringing the bell for a disqualification, but I head over to Jimmy and I grab him by the hair and I just sail him over the top rope. That leaves then me and the assassin in the ring alone with poor injured Ricky Gibson. Jimmy's trying to get back in the ring, but the assassin keeps him out. And I slowly and methodically make my move on Ricky as he struggles to get to his feet. He really has a hard time getting up because that one, his right leg is just basically gone. And I shoot in behind him and I put the fuller leg lock on him, on that same leg, the right leg. And he starts screaming. You can hear it all over the studio. And I start cranking on that injured knee. The assassin trying to keep Jimmy out and the other two baby faces out. And they're all about to get in there. But In comes the new heel, Rock Hunter. He just comes and slides into the ring and helps the assassin to keep all three of them at bay. And finally, it takes Ron Wright and Tommy Siegler added to that group of three before they can get into the ring and make me turn loose of the leg and slide out. Soon as I turn loose of Ricky's leg, I slide out on the floor. And now there's a group of baby faces huddled over top of him, and Ricky's just still screaming. Cameras continue to roll as Les Thatcher conveys what appears to be, because of that Fuller leg lock, a potential broken leg for Ricky Gibson. Everyone in the studio's on their feet. The ring is almost full of baby faces, and they bring a stretcher into the ring. They put Ricky on that stretcher, and Les doesn't close the segment until Ricky's been removed from the ring. The studio is absolutely electric at that point. I mean, that crowd is going nuts about what's gone down in the first two segments of the show.
Well, Ron, earlier in the show, you talked about security at the arena show, security at Chilhowie Park. Do you ever think you need security in a studio? Did it ever get that heated? I mean, specifically this instance, how heated was it in the studio?
Oh, it was very hot. But you know, the big difference between a studio and a big arena is the cameras. I think fans, you know, they say, I want to go in there and I want to do something about this, but boy, I don't want to go to jail. And I don't want them to know who I am, and I don't want them to really see my face, but I'd love to beat the hell out of them. But, you know, maybe this is not the right place. And I think that's kind of what happens for people in a television studio. We did have a policeman in our television studio in case something like that were to happen, but it doesn't get to that point yet. But we're not finished. So after the 2-minute commercial break for the station, Ron Wright and Tommy Siegler, they went to the set with Les for an interview. And boy, it's pandemonium in the studio. I mean, the fans are just they're just all on their feet. You can't get them to sit down. And as both guys had their say about the horrible way we had taken advantage of that injured young wrestler, both of them, Siegler and Ron Wright, they expressed their fear that Gibson had a broken leg. You know, and Les promised to keep the audience updated on the condition of Ricky Gibson as the show progressed. And wow, what a second segment of the show that was for great heat. And like I said before, it's not over yet. So for the first time ever on WBIR, we did a 5-minute personality profile live. And we had pre-recorded every one of these up to this point, but this one is done live. And even though we're in a separate studio, the crowd watching the monitors in the studio next door was so loud that they almost drowned out the participants in this week's personality profile. And guess who that would be? The assassin and myself again. Now, where this is the third or fourth time we've already been out there, this is a 5-minute segment. And we take that same video that the two baby faces, Gibson and Golden, had watched and complained about how we tried to break his leg and all that. And we just make fun of everything. We talk about during the 5 minutes about the video. We talk a little bit about the video and then how good it felt to hear Gibson's knee pop, you know, just a second ago. Did you hear that, Ron? Oh, I loved it. I could hear it. Boy, they had to be able to hear that downtown Knoxville, his leg breaking, you know, and we would not have to defend our titles now next Friday night as we were scheduled against Golden and Gibson, because Gibson probably got a broken leg, you know. And then I finished the 5-minute segment by I guaranteed the assassin that Gibson's got a broken leg. I said, I know it broke because that's the 10th leg I've broken with my dad's hole. And I know what a broken leg sounds like. And guarantee you, my man, that Ricky Gibson is in a hospital now somewhere. They are setting his leg. He's done like toast. Les did a fantastic job of being totally upset with what had already happened on this show and how concerned he was when the ambulance took Gibson to the hospital a few minutes earlier. This segment rocked. I mean, it was That 5 minutes was fantastic. The studio audience never stopped booing, and they weren't in the studio in which we were. They couldn't see us, but they were watching on the monitors. And Les was so obviously upset and apparently not able to hide it, out of control almost himself, and it just showing utter disdain for me and the assassin. It might have been, in my opinion, probably the best 5 minutes since Southeastern came to WBIR-TV.
Well, two questions, Ron. How do you continue with the show after that? And second of all, even when you're trying to build someone up, is there a risk of overexposure on one show? Because you've already been out there a bunch of segments.
Yeah, well, I don't think there really is. I mean, you know, I gave us a lot of thought because of Ricky's quick notice for me and not being able to set things up any better than I did. Let's work on the leg. Let's break his leg. Let's send him out of here with a good reason. And I don't think you can get too much heat, you know. And then this is one of those shows in which I've got to really put steam on me and the assassin to be able to keep the house up and maybe even jump the house. By the time we get to this point in the program, I'm feeling like we got a chance that we may pick up the house without Gibson being on the card. So we go to the third segment, and that features Tommy Sigler getting a win on TV against Tony Peters with his sleeper hold. And during the match, Les kept bringing up the awful events of the day and wondering what the card might look like for the next Friday night if Ricky Gibson did actually have a broken leg. He's kind of discussing this during the Tommy Sigler match. So we're keeping the focus on Gibson, the focus on us being real asses. The heat is just building throughout the entire show. After the match and another win for Sigler, Tommy goes to the desk and he watches his win from the night before against Steve Kyle. So this is another segment for Sigler that pushes him, because he does the same thing he did the last TV show. He's basically getting two wins in the same segment. He has beaten a guy live. Now he's watching him beat a guy from the night before. So after the 2 minute commercial break for the TV station, guess who joins them again at the desk? We go right back again and set. This is the fifth time in this show that we have been on the air. And we keep frustrating Les by asking him in jest if he heard anything about that terrible injury to Ricky Gibson. Can you imagine that? I mean, have you heard anything, Les? Did he get the broken leg? Oh, gosh, we're crying. We're just really rubbing it in big time. And Les is really selling it great. And then we finally say, well, who do you think we'd be wrestling next Friday night if poor Ricky Gibson's got a broken leg? So, you know, so we're really cranking out some tremendous heat here. And along with all that, there's a lot of good old heel laughter and lots of pats on the back between the assassin and I. The studio crowd, every time we're seen now, they all stand up and they all just start booing. You can't hear the interview. I wasn't sure that the fans at home were going to be able to hear what we were saying because the crowd was so loud at this point in the studio. The last segment, it's going to end with another bang, because the two baby faces, Ron Wright and Tommy Sigler, are going to come to the ring and they're going to wrestle together for the first time ever in a tag match. So what's happening here now is my top babyface team is being replaced in this program right here by Ron Wright and Tommy Sigler. The assassin and I are going to leave this show with more heat than we've ever had. Ron Wright and Tommy Sigler are going to jump right into the shoes of Golden and Gibson. And we're going to not only equal the crowd from the week before, we're going to blow the crowd away. We're going to do much better on the following week than we had in this show. So they're going to work with George McCrary and Dennis Condrey in a very short, wild, and brutal match that fit in perfectly with everything that's happened so far on this show. I mean, they just go out there. They really get into it with those guys. And I mean, beat the hell out of them. And then, you know, they set the tone for everything that's going to happen the following week at Knoxville's Chilhowee Park. During that match, Les makes the announcement to the home audience that word has just been received from the hospital that Ricky Gibson does indeed have a broken leg. After the match, in the two-minute station commercials, Les is joined to the set by Ron Wright, Tommy Siegler, and Jimmy Golden, who's just fresh back from the hospital. He rode in the ambulance with him to the hospital. Les begins the interview with a totally new card for the 4th of July event the following Friday due to the confirmed injury of Ricky Gibson with a broken leg. And this is what that card will be for the next Friday night, July 4th. Devoy Brunson versus George McCrary, the brand new Outlaw heel team, Cowboy Parker and Ken Dillinger versus Dennis Condrey and Rocky Smith, Don Wright versus Phil Hickerson, Jimmy Golden versus the new guy, Rock Hunter, who has already got a little steam, and Ron Fuller and the Assassin are going to have to defend our titles, not against the young boys, those young baby faces, but against those veterans of Tommy Siegler and Ron Wright. The main event then added to that card, because it's July 4th, is going to be a 14-man over-the-top rope battle royal on top of everything else. So there's a bit of a celebration from Ron Wright and Tommy Siegler about their title shot. And Jimmy Golden does a tremendous interview. He almost goes insane about, I'd want to wrestle both those guys by myself. I don't even have to have Ricky. I want to get my hands on them. He just kept harping on the fact that I want to get my hands on those two guys. And then he was, you know, he's talking about the loss of their belts and the even bigger loss of his friend and his partner, Ricky Gibson. And then he really honed in on, focused on that battle royal. And I love the fact that it's a battle royal, because I will get my hands on those two guys in that battle royal. And, you know, when I look back and I think about it, this is the kind of TV show was what's going to produce record TV audiences and Coliseum crowds for years in the future. It's a beginning for us of really building some heat and a great program and a great show that is just really focused on a lot of people and had a lot of really, really big time things happen during the course of this. And I couldn't wait for the next Friday night to see if I truly had turned that sow's ear into a silk's purse. You know, I mean, that's what the goal was. And I really felt at the end of this that, by golly, Ron, I think you may have done that. I believe you may have just turned that old sow's ear that was handed to you by Ricky into a silk purse.
Well, it sounds like you're pretty happy with the way things went on TV and coming out of it, that you may have come out of it even more ahead than you would have if you had Ricky Gibson, because you decided to really heat things up. But you promised earlier in the Studcast, what were the actual figures for the house show in Knoxville and the three-day weekend?
Okay, let's see. The house show on the June 27, 1975, was, the attendance was 3,200. And then it was a gross of almost $10,000, which is a pretty good night for me as a young promoter. It was we're about to reach a threshold that I thought it would take me a lot longer to get to. It was a total payroll that night of $2,800. The bottom guys got about $170 each, and the top guys got close to $300, $290 or so. And for the three-day weekend of June 27, 1975, with Middlesboro, Knoxville, and Morristown, was bottom guys got $335 for three nights' work, and the top guys got over $500 with $510. I was pretty darn happy with that. I was hoping that they would be happy with it. I was hoping that we could maintain this momentum we had going. And like you just mentioned a minute ago, I felt that I had taken a bad situation, something that could have been detrimental to a young company and to my talent, to see houses go down. You don't want your wrestlers to go out there and see a house down from what it was the week before. We've got some momentum going here, and I felt like I had really got that momentum still cranked, and we are still headed in the right direction. And with all this going, like this is not enough, I'm going to leave two days later on Monday morning and fly back to Florida for the first time I had been in Florida since I came to Knoxville back in October of 1974. Almost a year. We're getting fairly close to a year that I'd been out of there. And I'm going to wrestle in my old hometown of West Palm Beach on Monday night, June 30th, against Bob Roop for the Florida Heavyweight Championship in the main event. And this next night, I'm going to be flying from there into Tampa on July 1st, and I'm going to be wrestling Carl Krupp for the Southern Heavyweight Championship. So they bring me back to Florida, and they don't throw me mid-card. They don't throw me first match. They put me on top. I think there might have been a match above me in Tampa. I know we were on top, Roop and I, in West Palm. And I was very happy that with that. I felt like, you know, that I may go down there and they just want to just put me down the card somewhere and get somebody over. Instead, they took very good care of me, and I came out of there making a little money. And I came out of there with a lot of respect for Bill Watts, who's still there at this point and still running business. And they are still doing big business because the Dusty Rhodes turn is still not over. I mean, Dusty's going to stay and remain a hot figure in Florida until the day he leaves there.
Is there any backstory, any reason to your appearance here at the end of June, early July in Florida?
Not that I'm aware of. I get a call from Watts, and he says, "Ron, I'd like for you to come down and work a couple of shows for me. I could really use you." I don't know what his situation was. Maybe he had a baby face, a top baby face that needed to go somewhere, was out for a week. He might have been in a position similar to I am with Ricky. He got a 1 week notice, and he needs somebody that means something to pop into these matches, these title matches. And he wants to keep his houses up too and his momentum going too. He's booking. He's doing the same thing I'm doing in Tennessee. And I was more than happy to go there. I kind of missed being in Florida, to be honest with you, at that point for a little bit. And it was nice to get out of town and fly someplace rather than west toward Memphis or Louisville, Kentucky, and back down south into the deep south of Florida. And I really kind of enjoyed those 2 days in Florida that week.
Well, with that, Ron, another episode of the Studcast has come to a close. We want to remind you, on Facebook, become friends with the Tennessee Stud, the page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You could also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. Want to mention once again, Super Studcast number 20 out right now with the Universal Heartthrob, Austin Idol. This is a really funny one, also a really insightful one, a incredible edition of the Super Studcast that you need to check out today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Get in now because part two of this month's Super Studcast will be coming at you very, very soon. But Ron, where are we going here on the Studcast next week?
Well, we're going to start off next week, I think, kind of with a sad thing like we did this week in a way. We're going to talk about a freak accident that takes place in Johnson City, Tennessee in the month of June, 75, in this same time frame, that involves a wooden chair and the loss of a great young talent trained by Ron Wright, a guy named Ed Wolf, a big guy, strong dude, had a tremendous future ahead of him. Becomes a policeman, has everything going in his life, and somehow gets thrown out of the ring, lands on a wooden chair that splinters and punctures his thigh, and he loses a leg because of it. Just one of those freak accidents. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to go inside the beautiful Chilhowie Park Amphitheater. I haven't talked about this structure, but it's a fantastic night venue. Beautiful place, the way it's built back into a mountain and an amphitheater. And I'm going to describe the entire facility next week, and it's going to be the place that's going to host this fantastic card of July 4th, 1975 that we just talked about. I'm going to give the results of the payoffs for that show and the results of the matches. And I'm going to begin digging for American artifacts in Manchester, Tennessee, in my short career as an archaeologist. And I'm going to revisit the $100,000 Dale Lewis lawsuit and what's happening with it. We're going to come update everyone on what's going on with that.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.